Stay tuned to acure.org for the latest updates on the world's only conference dedicated to cardiac unloading and heart recovery. acure.org.
You are listening to Heart Sounds, TCTMD's award-winning podcast hosted by Shelley Wood.
Hello and welcome to Heart Sounds for April 2024. I do not know where the month has gone other than to say that much of it was taken up with our coverage of the 75th annual ACC meeting. With one exception, the entire TCTMD news team was in town with me, along with our film crew, so we have great coverage both in print and on camera from this meeting. My plan is to give you a taste of some of that in today's podcast. The lone exception I mentioned was Todd Neal, who we dearly missed in Atlanta. Todd at the time was attending the European Heart Rhythm Association meeting in Berlin and got a lot of great stories from that conference as well. For Heart Sounds this month, I will recap some of the top late-breaking trial news from ACC, plus give you a sample of what Todd was keeping tabs on in Berlin. Let's get started. Our most popular story from ACC was not about a win for a drug or a device, but in this case, a somewhat predictable loss. The REDUCE AMI trial, presented at ACC by Troels Indegen of Lund University and Skåne University Hospital, Sweden, is the latest study to question the long-term utility of beta blockers in patients with acute MI and preserved ejection fraction. Its conclusion, as many might have predicted, and indeed hoped, in the modern era of post-MI care, these agents do nothing to reduce the risk of death or recurrent MI. The Kaplan-Meier curves for the primary endpoint of death or recurrent MI were virtually overlapping, as Dr. Indegen put it, between the two treatment groups. Also speaking with TCTMD reporter Michael O'Riordan, Senior Investigator Thomas Jernberg of the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm said he predicts the broad recommendations for beta blockers after acute MI will likely be downgraded in the next guideline update. For now, he feels comfortable not starting post-MI patients on beta blockers provided the left ventricular ejection fraction is not compromised. 10 years ago, Shripal Bangalore of NYU Langone in New York led a meta-analysis of more than 60 trials and 100,000 patients, showing here too that beta blockers prescribed following acute MI did not reduce the risk of all-cause mortality in the reperfusion era. As he told TCTMD's senior clinical editor Mamas Mamas on camera, new randomized data are welcome.
Think about a patient who comes in with an AMI, that there is a sympathetic activation. I mean, the sympathetic activation is mainly protective. They're trying to increase your cardiac output, et cetera. But we also know that it leads to deleterious downstream effect, including increase in the risk of reentrant circuits, arrhythmia, et cetera. So in that context, beta blocker seems like a fantastic drug because they act on the sympathetic pathway. There have been a number of trials done in the acute MI space, and it took a meta-analysis of randomized trials done by Fremantle, published in 1999, combining all the trials, and what they showed was longer term there was a mortality benefit of using beta blockade in post-MI patients. But we really need to step back and say, when were the trials done, and does it reflect contemporary practice? Because beta blockers are one option to target sympathetic activation. Now we know that there are a number of different ways to do that, and the best way to target sympathetic activation acutely is to reperfuse them. And then we also have ACE inhibitors, ARBs, we have rehab, et cetera, all targeting sympathetic activation. So I think it's the right time to question whether whatever we saw back in the day is applicable to today's practice.
Another late breaker that made waves at ACC 2024 was danger shock. If you're a longtime reader of TCTMD, you know that we have been following the highs and lows of percutaneous mechanical circulatory support with Impella for years. Most of that work has taken the form of observational, propensity-matched analyses, and most of our coverage has been done by news editor Caitlin Cox. As our past stories make clear, cardiologists who use these devices swear by them, saying they've seen with their own eyes that they are helpful in high-risk scenarios where circulatory support is needed. Skeptics, on the other hand, point to the history of balloon pumps in many of these same types of patients and say there is simply no evidence that benefits outweigh harms, particularly in the very high-risk scenarios these devices are intended to be used. Enter Danger Shock, more than a decade in the making, having started in Denmark, then expanded to Germany and the UK. As Jakob Mueller of Copenhagen University Hospital in Denmark reported during a late-breaking presentation at ACC, the use of MCS with Impella CP microaxial flow pump in patients with acute MI complicated by cardiogenic shock appears to achieve lower mortality at 180 days compared with standard care. In all, investigators screened over 1,200 potential participants, ultimately enrolling just 360 patients with AMI and stage C, D, or E shock, randomizing them to receive standard care alone or MCS flow pump on top of standard care. You will need to read Caitlin's story to get full details on device success and crossovers, but ultimately, at 180-day follow-up, 45.8% of patients randomized to the Impella group had died from any cause, as compared with 58.5% in the control group, a statistically significant difference. The mean number of days alive and out of the hospital also favored MCS, but that came at the expense of more safety events. The number needed to treat in this trial to avoid one death was 8, while the number needed to harm was 6. Sunil Rao of NYU Langone in New York, who has spoken out in the past about the need for a randomized trial to settle the debate, joined me and Dr. Mueller for my video program On Record to discuss Danger Shock. I hope you'll tune in for that episode. Search Danger on TCTMD to find it, as well as Caitlin's print coverage. For now, here's part of what Dr. Rao had to say about having randomized data at last.
I think this is a huge leap forward. There are certainly people who say, see, I told you all along. And there are others who say, well, you know, the adverse events concern me. Mm-hmm. And I think probably both of them are right. Right? This is all-cause mortality. This is the hardest endpoint that we see in clinical trials. Yeah. It is indisputable that the device is beneficial. But I think the adverse events are really important. I think it's incumbent on our profession to figure out how to deal with them. I think what's going to happen, and what I hope happens, is that this serves as a flashpoint for smaller bore devices that provide the same amount of support. I think the amount of innovation in this space is really going to be pretty dramatic over the next few years.
Keeping with cardiac interventions a while longer, let's turn to Orbita Cosmic. You all know by now what Orbita has come to stand for. Rigorous, randomized, sham-controlled, or as the investigators prefer to say, placebo-controlled, trials in the device space. This one, presented by lead investigator Michael Foley of Imperial College London at ACC, showed that an implantable coronary sinus reducer in patients with refractory angina significantly reduced angina symptoms over 6 months of follow-up compared with a mock procedure in which no device was placed. Despite the reduction in the number of daily angina episodes, investigators were unable to fully uncover the mechanism of action with the reducer, with imaging data showing there was no improvement in myocardial blood flow to ischemic segments. The idea of using an hourglass-shaped device made of stainless steel mesh to reduce flow through the heart stems from a surgical ligation technique dating back to the 20th century. In Europe, the Neovasc Reducer has had CE mark approval since 2011, and in the US it's been designated a breakthrough device by the US Food and Drug Administration, but is not yet approved. In fact, in 2020, an FDA advisory committee voted against approving this device for patients with refractory angina, stating that more data were needed. Currently, the COSIRA II sham-controlled trial is underway with the intention of enrolling 380 patients with refractory angina. For Orbita Cosmic, all patients underwent adenosine stress cardiac magnetic resonance with perfusion mapping and were instructed on the use of a smartphone application to record the number of daily angina episodes throughout the study. Patients also completed symptom and quality of life questionnaires and other tests were done. As Dr. Foley showed in Atlanta, the trial showed no benefit in the device group as compared to the placebo group in stress myocardial blood flow in the segments deemed ischemic. That was the study's primary outcome. However, the ratio of endocardial to epicardial blood flow improved in the reducer group, with evidence of an effect between the ischemic and non-ischemic segments. Moreover, patients were more likely to have a lower number of daily episodes of angina, as recorded on the Orbita app, if they had the reducer in place. Dr. Foley, along with senior trial investigator Rasha Al-Lameh, also of Imperial College London, joined Mamas Mamas on camera to discuss the results, and both were careful to put the mixed findings in perspective. Dr. Foley, however, said he believes these results do offer some hope to patients who haven't been able to find relief for their pain.
I think there is sometimes a tendency when there's no further therapies that can be offered to start to think, well, maybe it's not angina in the first place and it lets you off the hook. I think that these patients did have angina. A lot of them had been sitting in clinic for a long time, not having any effective therapy. Some of them have been discharged back to their GP and their symptoms persisted. Hopefully now that we may have an effective therapy for that population. But I agree, it's crucially important that you establish that this is angina you're treating, and it's angina like you'd find in any other patient with the right character of the pain. Of course, myocardial ischemia is very, very important for a sort of sense check to make sure that you're, and that was an inclusion criteria in the trial. But really, these are patients with just very severe, very classic angina.
Dr. Al-Lameh was on hand to speak with TCTMD for another trial too. The PREVENT trial got a fair amount of buzz at ACC for revisiting an idea that I swear I'd heard bandied around more than a decade and a half ago: preventive stenting. This trial, led by Sungjung Park of Asan Medical Center in Seoul, Korea, compared optimal medical therapy alone to using PCI to treat what the investigators believed to be vulnerable plaques in non-flow-limiting coronary blockages with greater than 50% stenosis and negative fractional flow reserve, but certain characteristics of vulnerability. At 2 years, Park reported, patients randomized to the prophylactic PCI group had an 89% lower risk of the composite primary endpoint of cardiac death, target vessel MI, ischemia-driven target vessel revascularization, or hospitalization for unstable or progressive angina, compared with those in the OMT-only group. This trial got a few raised eyebrows at ACC. First, let's look at the definition of vulnerable in this study. Vulnerable in this study was defined as having at least two of the following characteristics: minimal lumen area of less than or equal to 4 millimeters squared by IVUS or OCT, plaque burden greater than 70% by intravascular imaging, thin cap fibroatheroma or TICFA detected by OCT or radiofrequency IVUS, and lipid-rich plaque detected by NIRS. But in the end, 95% of patients in the trial were assessed by grayscale IVUS, not any of the newer, more sensitive imaging modalities. Moreover, PREVENT had originally been designed with the plan to use a bioresorbable stent, which makes a little more sense when you're thinking about sticking a stent in a lesion that, by current standards, has no reason to be treated. When the absorbed stent was taken off the market, the trial proceeded with permanent drug-eluting stents instead. Lastly, people had questions about just how optimal OMT was in this study. Only 2% of patients got a PCSK9 inhibitor, which are the agents with perhaps the most evidence for plaque pacification in coronary disease. That brings us back to Dr. Al-Lameh, who was not involved in the study, but in an interview with TCTMD, said she hopes people take the PREVENT study results with a sizable grain of salt.
I think this is a very interesting trial. Vulnerable plaque is definitely a space that I'm interested in. I do think there's a future in terms of thinking about vulnerability of plaque and how it predicts events and what we might do about it. However, I think the devil's in the detail. What do we mean by vulnerable plaque? And for me, the PREVENT trial didn't show patients with vulnerable plaque per se, but patients with high plaque burden. And we've known for a long time that if they are physiologically negative, these lesions are non-flow limiting. The right thing, I think, to do in these lesions is to give them very intense lipid-lowering therapy, manage their risk factors. Now, what's interesting in this trial is that actually the proportion of patients who had more sensitive tests, OCT, near-infrared spectroscopy, to look for vulnerability was very low. Mm-hmm. And our ability to detect vulnerability on grayscale IVUS is not in the same league. And finally, I think it's important to think about the endpoints that we study. And we know that in our unblinded trials, unplanned revascularization or triggering of revascularization events based on symptoms is often driven by the fact that we saw a narrow lesion that we left alone in the medical therapy only arm. And so I'd caution people to think about those drivers when looking at the endpoints.
There is much, much more I could tell you about from ACC24. We had in-depth print coverage and video interviews for all of the trials I've just touched on, but also MPACT-MI, which looked at starting empagliflozin immediately after an acute MI, RELIEVE-HF, which saw an interatrial shunt being tested in heart failure, with disappointing results. We had STEP-HFpEF-DM, helping to clarify how semaglutide might be helping the heart beyond its effects on weight loss, and ULTIMATE-DAPT, yet another study addressing the possibility of dropping aspirin 1 month after PCI. For all of those and more, please head to TCTMD and click on the Conference tab to navigate to our ACC conference page. That's also where you'll find Todd Neal's stories from the EHRA meeting in Berlin, as I mentioned. Todd had stories on the exploding field of pulsed field ablation, a new consensus statement on surgical and catheter ablation in AF, new research on the link between cognition and AFib, and much more. A topic he heard raised at this heart rhythm meeting was the need for more awareness of the link between atrial fibrillation and heart failure. Serendipitously, a Danish group writing in the BMJ published an analysis shortly after Todd was back from Europe. Niklas Winter and colleagues, drawing on Danish national registries spanning 2000 to 2022, estimate that 2 out of every 5 patients diagnosed with AFib will develop heart failure thereafter, making it a much more frequent complication of AF than stroke. Todd put the question to Renata Schnabel of the University Medical Center Hamburg-Eppendorf in Germany. Is the risk of heart failure after a new AFib diagnosis getting the attention it deserves?
Probably not yet. And of course, it has been relatively easier to show individuals the high risk of stroke through thromboembolism. This is easy to understand usually. And everybody fears a debilitating stroke. So this is something you can communicate well. And we have good treatment now with the drugs to reduce the risk of stroke. It's more difficult, I think, in communication and understanding for heart failure, although we certainly know that heart failure is the most common cause of death in atrial fibrillation patients. So this is known also to healthcare professionals, but it's probably the emotionality that is behind stroke that really puts it into the foreground.
That's it for Heart Sounds for April 2024. I hope you'll consider browsing TCTMD on your phone every time your zombie fingers are drawn to social media or Roblox or Candy Crush, whatever the cool kids are playing. I'd like to think we can inform and engage you, not to mention saving you the 20 minutes you might otherwise lose to cute raccoon videos on Instagram. In addition to print news on TCTMD, our newly launched video center has interviews with many of the leading voices in cardiology, and I promise you, we don't let them off lightly. There are also several other podcasts, including RockSart Radio, where this month, host Roxana Moran delves deeper into the danger shock trial with Dr. Mueller. The whole TCTMD crew is shipping out again imminently to different cardiology meetings, and I know you can't be in all places at once. Over the next few weeks, we'll have breaking news from SCAI, the ESC Heart Failure Meeting, EuroPCR, HRS, and the European Stroke Congress. If you have story tips for any of these meetings or other things you think I should know about, please reach out. My email is swood@tctmd.com. I'm on the platform formerly known as Twitter as ShellyWood2, and I'll be practicing my French at EuroPCR later this month. If you see me out and about, please say bonjour. Thank you for tuning in to Heart Sounds.
Do you love listening to Heart Sounds? Check out all new original content from TCTMD featuring Talking Points with Dr. C. Michael Gibson and Rocks Heart Radio with Dr. Roxana Moran. All new episodes are available on Google Play, iTunes, Spotify, and SoundCloud.